Now, John, another aspect of your interest in the energy balance was really an interest in the more climatological aspects of it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Quite a series of papers in the Quarterly Journal of the Royal Meteorological Society deriving from that.
Yes, that's right. I started looking at the records of radiation, solar radiation, from a number of stations that were published by the Meteorological Office in the monthly weather report, and found some interesting differences across the country, and started trying to relate these to differences in sunshine hours and things of that kind, and got particularly interested in some of the measurements on the west coast in Wales at Aberporth and also at Valencia.
Mm-hmm.
Penman used to tease me about my concern for the excesses at Aberporth, and this became a standing joke in the department. But it wasn't just Aberporth, Valencia was involved as well, and the most likely explanation seemed to be that both these stations were benefiting from time to time from very, very clean air coming in across the Atlantic, so that there was not just a cloud effect involved, but a very important aerosol effect as well. And we'll come on to that subject again when we talk about Southern Bonython. I did a little paper also on long wave radiation, showing how you could relate that to the vapor pressure or to the precipitable water in the atmosphere, using an extension of some of Brunt's ideas. And it was for these papers and one or two others that I eventually was awarded the Buchan Prize of the Royal Meteorological Society. Mm-hmm. To my great delight, Sawyer and I shared the prize 1 year.
Now, going back to the energy balance, heat balance interests, that led on presumably to some of your early measurements of evaporation.
Yes, that's right. In order to close the heat balance, as people say nowadays, we never used the term at the time, made a couple of very large, well, in those days, very large weighing machines, which were built for us at Silso by L.G. Morris and his colleagues, the man who designed my dew balance suspension system. And they were made on exactly the same principle. We were able to weigh and measure small changes of weight of pans that were, 40 inches square and 20 inches deep. So they held quite a good deal of soil. And they were buried with the top of the pan flush with the field. And the thing was counterweighted in such a way that very small changes in weight of the pan switched on an electric motor that drove a small counterweight along the arm of the counterweighting system, and the position of that weight was then recorded again with a good old microbarograph drum, the old system that I'd used previously. But this was just a pen and ink job. And we, in order to run this system and service it daily, we had to climb down into a pit, which usually had water in the bottom of it, and there were all sorts of mains, leads and terminals and things around. I shudder to think now what the health and safety people would say if they'd seen something like that. The work would have been stopped instantly. But we did get some pretty good measurements of evaporation from these records. About that time, I met a visitor to the department, Yehuda Neumann, who was professor of meteorology in the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And as a result of that meeting, he invited me to go out to Israel for 3 months with support from WMO to look at a lot of measurements that they'd made at the Lydda airport of evaporation from water surfaces and from grass-covered surfaces. And these were lying around, and they weren't really quite sure what to do with them all. So in the autumn of 1959, I went out and spent an extremely enjoyable 3 months in Israel. The meteorological service there, under Mr. Gillard looked after me very well and made sure that every weekend they made an excuse to go and visit a Met station in some part of the country. So I saw virtually the whole of Israel as it was in those days, from Galilee right down to Eilat, and wrote up a report about the work that they'd done there, which really started me thinking more deeply about how you could parameterize and find a useful formula for evaporation from vegetated surfaces. Up to that time, I'd rather kept off evaporation as a theme, because Penman, of course, had made his name for that, and he was the expert, and I didn't feel there was very much I could add to what he had done. But in the course of playing around with the equations, I hit on the idea of trying to parameterize the empirical wind function that Penman had used, using an aerodynamic resistance which depended on wind speed at some arbitrary height and on the surface roughness and displacement term, and complementing that with a second resistance, which was the biological resistance, the effective resistance of the stomata, treating the whole canopy as if it was just one single leaf.
Was the resistance idea something that had come from other work before yours, or was this the first time resistance really came into the subject?
I think it may have been the first time. I'm not sure about that, so I wouldn't like to be too dogmatic about it. But I was looking the other day at the first paper when I really presented some of these ideas, which was given to the meeting that was set up to celebrate the opening of the Canberra Phytotron in 1962. And I was invited by Lloyd Evans, who organised that meeting, to go and talk about the work that I'd been doing, on both on the water story and on the carbon dioxide story that we'll come on to in a minute. And in that paper I have drawn a resistance analogue for the CO2 and for water vapor, which I think may be the first time that something of that kind appeared, but it appeared many times since, of course.
I remember dealing with it when I did something for sulfur dioxide, and using exactly that paper.
Right. Yes. Yes, I think it was a new idea, and in fact, even in 1962, when I was talking about the idea of a surface resistance, I still hadn't developed it fully into what later became known as the Penman-Monteith formula. Thinking of 1962, that visit to Australia gave me the opportunity of a very enjoyable round-the-world trip. And before I got to Australia, I'd spent a month with F.A. Brooks and his colleagues at Davis, California. And they had some superb lysimeters and lots of magnificent measurements. And I wrote up a little paper for something they were publishing at the time on my method of extracting a surface resistance, and I was always extremely disappointed that they made absolutely no use of that concept subsequently and went on using empirical methods to analyze their evaporation measurements. And it was not until just a year or two ago that one of the members of that team, Bill Pruitt, started using surface resistances in this formula. So the idea took a long time to settle in there.
It's very noticeable since I moved to North America. Mm-hmm. That it is still not entirely sort of embedded in analysis.
That's curious.
There's little, not really the understanding of the fundamental basis.
Yes. Well, of course, it wasn't just in North America, but in Australia I met violent opposition when I talked at that Canberra meeting, and you have seen the comments that were made by people like John Phillip and Taylor and Swinbank, all of whom thought that the idea of a surface resistance was just ridiculously simplistic, and that because of the very complex differences in exchange processes for momentum and heat and water vapor, within a canopy, you couldn't possibly treat the system in such a simple way. Eventually, of course, they were proved to be over-cautious about it, but it did take another, 20-25 years or so before Raupach and people in Canberra produced a good theory of exchange processes within canopies in terms of the two-field model, and were really able to show that there were some circumstances in which my simple method worked and others in which it didn't. You know that nice paper about simple models are, how does it go again? Complex models of flown canopies are correct but useless, and simple models are wrong but useful. Discuss,
yes.
And that really sums up very nicely, I think.
How did Penman react to these developments of
Penman encouraged me, although I do remember that when I gave him the draft manuscript of the 1965 paper, which was really the main paper describing this work that I'd been doing, he passed it back to me with only one comment, which was on the length of the paper rather than the content, and his comment was, "Bit of a Mahler symphony, isn't it, John?" But it was fortunately accepted in the form in which I submitted it. Full of mistakes, of course, as so many of my papers have been, but other people have managed to correct them. And the interesting thing is that I realized much later, when I was writing my presidential address on evaporation and surface temperature, that Penman had done the algebra for what is now called the Penman-Monteith equation long ago in terms of single leaf processes. The equation has he derived an equation with an identical form, just a different interpretation of the two resistances. So
that's interesting. It's not very well known.
Not well known. No. Yes. But it was published in a fairly obscure place, I think, proceedings of a meeting of an international horticultural society or something like that.
So this while this work in evaporation was going on, you weren't only carrying that, were you? You were developing other fuels.
Well, yeah, that led on then to a desire to get a better handle on the carbon dioxide exchange. And it was just about this time that more sensitive CO2 analyzers were coming on the market, and Ed Lemon at Cornell had done pioneering work on measuring CO2 fluxes or estimating CO2 fluxes from very small gradients of carbon dioxide of the order of a few parts per million, which could be measured above field crops. And it was round about 1960, I think, that we had a visitor at Rothamsted from the Rockefeller Foundation, and Penman told him that we were interested in getting involved in this line of work, and Rockefeller came up with the funds for the first really sensitive infrared gas analyzer that was made in Britain, with a full-scale deflection of somewhere between 5 and 10 parts per million. And again, by one of these very fortunate accidents, this thing was built by the Infrared Development Company at Welwyn Garden City, which was within 20-25 minutes' drive from Rothamsted. So Geza and I went over and talked to Bill Bartley, who was the managing director, about the requirement, and he said he thought it would be possible to do it, and I was a bit doubtful as to whether they could increase the sensitivity of their existing instruments by at least one order of magnitude or a bit more. And I remember going home that night and thinking about it in the bath and then deciding it probably could be done. And the next morning, Bartley rang me up at work and said, "I've been thinking about our discussion yesterday and I doubt whether it could be done." And I said, "I've been thinking about it, I'm sure it can." Well, fortunately, he went ahead and did succeed in making an instrument with that very high sensitivity. The only trouble was that in those days, the detectors were never properly sealed. They didn't have the knack of sealing off the CO2 detector with a diaphragm in between the two chambers. And you were very lucky if you didn't have to take them back for refilling inside about a couple of weeks. But in spite of that, we did manage to get the first measurements ever made in Europe, I think, not just in Britain, but in Europe, of CO2 fluxes above a field of sugar beet. And published a paper in the Quarterly Journal showing the size of the fluxes and estimating dramatic reduction from that.
And is that what led you on in terms of interpreting those fluxes into an interest in sort of radiation
yeah.
in crop canopies?
Yes, that's right. The next question was, well, if we can measure the total net CO2 flux, how can we break this down into the contributions from different layers of leaves? And then we started thinking of some kind of instrument that would measure radiation in an inhomogeneous canopy where you've got leaves of all sorts of different sizes and shapes, so that there was a problem of spatial integration. Now, it was very fortunate, none of these fortunate accidents, I'm sure that none of them are really accidents, that on the way back from Australia, I called in at Japan and seen, made by a man called Isobe, a neat little solarimeter in a tubular format. And this thing was just about 12 inches long and half an inch in diameter or something like that. And it struck me that this would be ideal for getting averages of the radiation at different depths within a canopy. And went back to Rubenstead and Geza and I decided to use the good old Wilson and Epps technique to make a strip which was about 3 feet long and 1 inch wide with thermocouples all along it with a black and white checkerboard pattern that helped to prevent any bias from heating of the tube on one side. And that, of course, ultimately became a fairly standard instrument and was manufactured by Delta T devices, who are still selling a lot of them every year. And from that I began to be interested in models of canopy photosynthesis and published a paper in the Annals of Botany on that subject, which I didn't take any further at the time, but it was a fairly early attempt to try to put together ideas about light transmission and photosynthesis.
It's always seemed to me that this period of time while you were at Rothamsted also sort of coincided with a great interest in agricultural meteorology worldwide. You were very much part of that, weren't you?
Yes, I think it was an important growth period, and one of the activities that stimulated a lot of that growth was the International Biological Programme. Which lasted for several years at the beginning of the 1960s. This was the kind of biologist's answer to the International Geophysical Year. And there were committees set up all around the world and a number of international committees, and I sat on a small subcommittee for photosynthesis for a number of years. They had meetings in different places. The one I remember chiefly was in Copenhagen when we dealt with the subject of plant environments. And at all of these meetings, people got together and exchanged ideas about experimental work and theoretical work and the general directions of the subject. And it did form a very important jumping-off ground, really, for things that came in the couple of decades that followed.
Also, I suppose, from all the work that came out of your time at Rothamsted, there's one particular paper that is most heavily cited, the evaporation and environment paper.
Yeah.
It's always struck me as being in a rather unusual place.
Yes.
How did that actually come about?
Well, it came about through an invitation from the Society of Experimental Biology to give a paper at a meeting that they held in Swansea in 1964, where there was a session on water vapor or something of that kind, evaporation of water vapor. And that invitation just happened to come at the time a lot of my ideas about evaporation were crystallizing. So instead of putting them into in a more formal way into a learned journal, I gave the paper in a fairly condensed form at that Swansea meeting. It was a rather important meeting in another way too, because it was attended by one of the staff from Nottingham University School of Agriculture, Fred Milthorpe, who was Professor of Agricultural Botany. And when we were sitting having coffee one morning, he said to me, "You know, I think it is quite likely that in about 3 years' time, Nottingham will be advertising for a Professor of Environmental Physics. And I wonder whether you would be interested." So I was completely taken by surprise, never having thought of myself as working in an academic institution. And I said, "Well, thank you very much for telling me about it." And pretty well put it at the back of my mind, because I didn't think it would ever happen.
Presumably you were feeling very settled at Rothamsted with a growing family at this stage?
Yes, that's right. It's something that we haven't touched on yet. But my marriage and my family have played an extremely important part in my life, and I wouldn't like the people listening to this or reading this think that I was just preoccupied entirely with things that went on in the laboratory and the field. Just to go back a little bit, I had met when I was 20, I think, a girl who went to the same church youth fellowship as I did. And we got on very well together and continued to correspond at weekly intervals when I went to London to Imperial College. And we were engaged when I was 23, I think, and married in 1955 when I was 25, married in the church that we had belonged to in Edinburgh. And that was the start of an extremely happy partnership, still continues. In Harpenden, between 1956 and 1965, we had 5 children, so we were really kept pretty busy. Elsa certainly was, and I had quite a bit of responsibility at home too, of course, bringing up this young family. We had to move house once or twice in order to accommodate the expanding family. And in 1964, we moved into a house which was a nice big semi-detached Edwardian house that we really didn't want to move.
And this was exactly at the time, really, that Fred Milthorpe was telling you about this?
Exactly. So when finally Fred Milthorpe's prediction came true, and Nottingham didn't advertise chair in environmental physics, and he simply wrote to me and asked whether I would like to apply because there weren't very many people around who had the requisite kind of background and experience. So a great deal of heart searching about it. I told Pembroke what was going on, and he looked distinctly displeased. Discussed it a lot with Elsa, and finally decided that I had been at Rothamsted for 18 or 19 years by then, and we both felt that despite the domestic upheaval, in terms of my career advancement, it was the right thing to do. Penman was within about 7 years of retirement, and I might have hoped that I had some opportunity to succeed him, but 7 years seemed a long time. When you're young, it does.
Did the academic life attract you, or just the sort of the prospect of a move was the more important feature?
It was really the prospect of being able to start in a new place and develop my own lines of science and attract people in a way that was impossible at Rothamsted because of the small size of the department, because of limited budgets, and because I never had any hope really of getting more than one research assistant. Things were all done, and done very well, but on a very small scale. So I eventually went up for my interview at Nottingham and sat in the anteroom of the Senate in front of a number of very senior people and told them of the things that I would like to do if I was appointed. And then they sent me out into the big Senate room, and I sat there for a moment or two wondering what was going to happen, and suddenly there was a great gale of laughter. And I'm still wondering today what that was about. And I came back in again after a few minutes and they offered me the job and I accepted it. So that really was a tremendous change, both professionally and domestically.
So when you moved to Nottingham, you moved there in 67?
67, yes, it was the autumn of 1967. I should tell you one more little bit of that history before we move on, and that is when I came back from the interview and told Howard Penman that I'd been offered the job and that I'd accepted it, he seemed to be completely dumbfounded. And he sat staring out of his window for, I'm sure, at least 15 minutes, saying nothing. One of the most uncomfortable experiences that I've ever had, I think. And he just seemed to be completely shattered by the news and didn't know how to respond. And I heard later, wrote a very bitter letter to Nottingham University, saying more or less that they were baby snatching or word to that effect.
What a shame.
Yeah, it was a great pity. But he came round a bit after that and gave me a farewell party, and we parted on very good terms, and I continued to see him, of course, thereafter.
Well, we used to see him from time to time. Yeah. It was always a fairly frightening experience.
Yes, that's
for young
right.
people like
yeah.
me having to depend on it.
Yeah.
Now let's turn then to the period of time at Nottingham University and tell us a bit about how you developed the department, what happened in those years.
Yes, it was not entirely a question of starting from scratch, because Fred Millthorpe, who'd suggested the Nottingham move to me initially, and John Hudson, who was Professor of Horticulture, had both been very interested in developing aspects of agro-meteorology in relation to field crops and to horticulture. And they in fact had an MSc in water relations running for several years. And a number of very good people, notably Ian Cowan, who had been appointed as a lecturer in agricultural botany, was a very good physicist who did his PhD on exchange processes in canopies and completed that just about the time that I went to Southern Bonington and then disappeared to Australia. But it was a new beginning insofar as no lectures on specifically on environmental physics had been given before. So I had to start off for the first time in my life developing a lecture course to final year students, as one was one of the final year options, and there were just four students who'd opted to do it that year. There was a girl who subsequently, I think, went on to do plant research in Glasgow. There was Rob Sunderland, who eventually did a PhD in water, plant water relations in Reading, who I was in touch with for quite a few years afterwards. And then there were two chaps known as the Hairy Twins. They never contributed anything to the discussion, and I'm afraid I've forgotten their name and I never heard of them after they graduated. But also I had Jerry Clark, who had been appointed as a lecturer in environmental physics before I arrived. And so Jerry Clark sat in on the course and was later able to teach elements of that subject himself, of course. Within a couple of years or so, it was clear that environmental physics wasn't going to get very far just with myself and one lecturer, So we advertised for a second lecturer. And we, again, as in the case of Geza Zeitz, we only had one applicant whom we thought was at all suitable. And you were that applicant. So here's another very happy accident. Because we thought, well, this guy's got a BSc degree from Edinburgh Physics Department, so we know that's all right. But he's done his PhD in properties of X-ray equipment in the Medical Physics Department, and that doesn't sound entirely relevant. In fact, we wondered whether you'd misread the advertisement, which included the word radiation, and thought that there was some kind of X-ray physics going on at the School of Agriculture. Anyway, to cut a long story short, we decided that you had the right kind of attitude to things, and we appointed you, and it was something that I was very thankful for later, because you made an enormous contribution to the work of that department before you left us. Anyway, we fairly quickly managed to get research funds for work in a number of areas that I wanted to develop. There were things that I told the committee that I was interested in when I was interviewed. One of them was to look in more detail at the microclimatology of crops in relation to water use and carbon dioxide assimilation, and we managed to get some funds from the Nuffield Foundation for that. Then there was the water balance of the local catchment area, the Kingston Brook, which runs down into the River Soar, and we got funds from the Natural Environment Research Council for doing that, and Mike McGowan in our soil chemistry unit collaborated with me in that work. And then I'd been interested for quite a while at Rothamsted in the application of environmental physics to the heat balance of animals. But at Rothamsted, of course, I'd never been able to do anything with animals. And Eric Lemming, who was the head of the Department of Physiology and Environmental Science that environmental physics was part of, was an animal physiologist who was quite keen to see some work starting in this area. And we were fortunate there to recruit a Polish physicist, Chris Senna, who was interested in the field, and also to get some money from the Science Research Council to support him. So these were three externally supported areas, and then I was still keen to do a bit more work on radiation climatology, and we didn't need external funding for that because we had the equipment in-house, and because you, after you came along, expressed an interest in working in that aspect of radiation and really took it over from me as your own experience developed.
Yeah, we sort of built on the excesses at
Apple. That's right,
didn't
yes.
we? That
yeah.
was really the topic yeah. You pointed me at when I arrived. Mm-hmm. I knew very little about which areas I should work in, and so it was four years or so we worked together on the short wave and the long
that's,
wave.
That's right, and we got a number of papers that appeared in the Quarterly Journal, of course, at that time, out of that work.
Did the concept of a book based on the course always sort of, was it always there in your mind, or did you decide to write the book quite independently of your teaching interests?
I can't quite remember the sequence of events, but it must have been about that time that I was approached by Edward Arnold to see if I could produce some kind of a textbook that would cover the subjects that I'd been working on in my research. And of course it followed very naturally from the lecture course and the arrangement of the subjects there. It followed quite naturally that I could write this up in a form that was suitable for publication as a book. It was a lot more work than I realized when I embarked on the job, but it eventually got finished and was published in 1972 or 73 or something like that.
The other book that you did that for me was very influential, for a lot of other people too, I think, is the two volumes of Vegetation and the Atmosphere.
Mm,
They were interesting because they were so international in their flavor.
Yes.
Did they sort of come out of your international travels around those times?
Well, yes, I think it came out particularly of the kind of contacts that I've been able to make through the International Biological Programme, so that I knew nearly all the major people internationally who were working on vegetation, atmosphere, soil interactions. And that meant that there was no major problem in recruiting people to do the work. And I look back on that particular exercise now with quite a lot of satisfaction, because I know that people have found it useful. And it did summarize the state of the art at that point. There's never been anything quite comparable with it since. Incidentally, I think you might be interested to know or to be reminded that for a long time I considered the possibility of having a volume 3 dealing with pollution. But that's something that you ought to write rather than me.
Well, I remember at the time, especially when I was just starting at Southern Bonington, that you did some sort of fairly major international travel, didn't you?
Yeah.
So maybe we should talk a bit about that.
Yes, yeah. At Rothamsted, of course, I'd started my international travels, but there was one very significant excursion that I made just before I left Rothamsted, when Hugh Bunting, who was professor of agricultural meteorology, of agricultural botany at Reading, arranged for me to go out to visit the Ahmadu Bello University in northern Nigeria, where one of his staff, Jeremy Elston, was working at that particular time. And this was my first exposure to tropical agriculture, and I found it very interesting to see the very wide range of new problems in the impact of a semi-arid climate on crop production that I hadn't met before. So that was something that started to get me involved in the tropical work that was to become a major part of my activity a bit later on. And then in 1970, the UNESCO joined up with what was left of the International Biological Programme to organise a meeting on productivity of tropical ecosystems in Uganda, Kampala. So I gave a paper at that on solar radiation and productivity, and then I went on to Malawi and Kenya. And then I got one or two invitations to Brazil from Paulo Alvim, a plant physiologist at the Cocoa Research Station, and visited there once or twice. And in 1974, I paid my first visit to the institute that I was ultimately to move to from Sutton Bonington, which was one of the fairly newly set up international institutes under the control of the Consultative Group for International Agricultural Research. And this one was known as ICRISAT, and the acronym stands for the International Crops Research Institute for the Semi-Arid Tropics. So I called in there in 1974, just a couple of years after they had started, and talked to the staff there, and then went on to the Rice Research Institute, which was a sister institute in the Philippines, to attend a meeting on rice climates. From there I continued my travels to Fiji, and enjoyed that visit for the first time.
Yes, of course, that was a link that Nottingham has continued to
yeah,
keep up.
That's right.
Exchanges.
Yeah.
Yes.